The treatment of the scrolls was an art form more than an exact science. For each of them, the treatment varied, depending on their state of preservation, the quality of the leather, the composition of the ink, and other interrelated factors. Sally admitted to me in a weak moment that she would not have been able to handle the task. It required a fund of acquired experience which she did not have at her command. Eldridge worked like a medieval alchemist, steaming, soaking, spraying, and painting. His domain stank of chemicals and other weird smells, and his and Sally's fingers were stained. Sally reported that his absorption with the task had reduced his animal instincts to the level where he made only spasmodic and half-hearted clutches at the protruding parts of her anatomy. As each scroll was unrolled, its contents were evaluated, and the detailed translation began. One after another, they proved to be either books of account on the city's trade, or proclamations made by the Grey Lion and the Council of the Nine Families. The authors were nameless clerks, and their style was brisk and economical, with little time for poetic flights or unnecessary descriptive passages. This starkly utilitarian outlook echoed the lifestyle, which we had so far reconstructed from our finds on the site. We discussed it at the nightly talk sessions. "Typically Punic," Eldridge agreed. "They had little taste in the visual arts. Their pottery was coarse and mass-produced. In my opinion, their sculpture, what little there was downright hideous." "It requires wealth and leisure and security to produce art," I suggested. "Yes, that's true. Rome and Greece are examples of that. Carthage and earlier, Phoenicia, were often threatened on occasion, struggling for survival. They were the bustlers and the hustlers, traders and warriors, more concerned with wealth and the acquisition of power than the niceties of living." "You don't have to go back that far. Modern art comes from the great wealthy and secure nations." "And we white Africans are like the own Carthaginians," Sally said. "When there's gold in them there hills, who gives a hoot about painting pictures?" The scrolls reinforced the theory. Gold from Zimbabwe and Punt, ivory from the southern plains of grass or from the forests along the great river, hides and dried meat, salted fish from the lakes, wine and oil from the terraced gardens of Zeng, copper from the hills of Tuya, and salt from pans along the west shores of the lake, tin from the juncture of the two rivers, corn from the Middle Kingdom in baskets of woven cane, sunstones from the southern river of the Crocodile, iron bars from the mines of Sala, and slaves, thousands upon thousands of human beings treated as domestic animals. The chronicle was dated from an undisclosed point in time. We suspected this as the date of the founding of the city, and each entry was prefaced by such dating as, "In the year 169, the month of the elephant." From these we deduced a 10-month year based on a calendar of 365 days. Once the nature of the scrolls had been established, I suggested to Eldridge that rather than work systematically through the collection from beginning to end, we sample them and try to establish the overall history of our city. He fell in with my wishes, and there evolved a picture of a widespread colonization of Central and Southern Africa by a warlike and energetic people based on the city of Opet and ruled by the hereditary king, the Grey Lion, and an oligarchy of nine noble families. The decrees of this council covered a range as wide as the measures adopted for dredging the channels of the lake and preventing the encroachment of waterweed, to the choice of messengers to be sent to the gods Baal and Astarte. Here Astarte seemed to have taken precedence over the more usual Carthaginian form Tenit. Messengers, we suspected, were human sacrifices. We discovered carefully recorded family trees, based, like the Jewish system, on a matrilinear system. each noble man or woman could trace his or her line back to the founding of the city. It was also clear from the chronicle that their religion was part of their scheme of living, and we could reasonably guess that it was a conventional form of polytheism, with leading male and female godheads, Baal and Astarte. As we moved forward in time, so we found new factors intruding, new contingencies occupying the attention of the ruling king. The rapid shrinking of the waters of the Lake of Opet began to threaten the city's lifeline, and in the year 296, the Grey Lion sent 7,000 slaves to assist with the work of keeping the channels open to the sea. He also dispatched a column of 1,000 of his own guards under the war captain Ramos with orders to venture eastwards towards the rising sun, stopping not, nor failing in determination, until he had reached the eastern sea and had discovered the route to the lands of the north, whose existence was postulated by the sea captain and navigator Habakkuk Lau. A year later, Ramos returns with only 70 men, the others having perished in a land of pestilential swamps and putrid fevers. He had, however, reached the eastern sea, and there found a city of traders and seafarers, dark men and bearded, dressed in fine linens, and binding their brows with the same material. They come from a land beyond the eastern sea, and Ramos is rewarded with 20 fingers of gold and 20 slaves. Our men of Opet have made their first contact with the Arabs, known to them as the Dravs, who are colonizing the Sofala coast. We learnt how the Grey Lion's search for a new source of slave labor becomes desperate. Orders are dispatched to the mine overseers to take all measures to prolong the working lives of their slaves. Rations of meat and corn are increased, inflating the cost of production but increasing the life expectancy of the slaves. Owners are enjoined to breed all female slaves regularly, and the practice of infibulation is discontinued. The slaving expeditions are sent further and further afield, as the Yui are hunted down. From the description of these yellow-skinned Yui, we guessed that they were the ancestors of Hottentot people. Then, suddenly, the Grey Lion is delighted by the return of a northerly expedition with 500 savage Nubians, both tall and strong, and the leader of the expedition is rewarded with 10 fingers of gold. This delight fades slowly over the following 100 years as a solid mass of black humanity builds up north of the great river. The vast Bantu migrations had begun, and now the concern of the Grey Lion is to dam the flood southwards, and his legions march constant patrol upon the northern border. Our samplings gave us these fleeting glimpses into the past, but they were recorded as bland, impersonal statements of fact. How we long to find the writings of a Pliny or a Livy, to give flesh and breath to these meticulous records of acquired wealth. Each fact seemed to present us with 100 unanswered questions. Of these, the most pressing was, where did they come from, these men of Opet, and when? Where did they go to, and why? We hoped the answers to the major questions were here somewhere in this maze of writings, and in the meantime we occupied ourselves with finding the lesser answers. It was easy enough to locate the places mentioned in the chronicles, Zimbau and Punt, where the southern and northern territories of modern Rhodesia. The great river was the Zambezi. The lakes had disappeared. The gardens of Zeng were clearly the hundreds of thousands of acres of terraced hillsides in the Inyanga area of eastern Rhodesia. The hills of Tuya must be the copper-rich country above Sinoya. Step by step, we established the presence of our men of Opet at nearly all of the ancient sites, and at the same time we had a picture of the building up of an immense treasure. For although the bulk of this wealth was sent outwards, yet there recurred the words a tenth part to the Gray Lion. Where had this treasure been stored, and what had become of it? Had it perished with the city, or was it still here in some secret storehouse, carved from the red rock cliffs of the Hills of Blood? As a mental exercise, I made an estimate of the extent of this treasure. Assuming that a finger of gold was one of the finger-like rods of the precious metal we'd discovered among the foundations of the city, I listed the total inflow of gold recorded in 20-odd sample years, beginning in the year 345 and ending in the year 501. I found that previous estimates had been hopelessly inadequate. Instead of 750 tons of gold, I found that the total recovery from the ancient mines could not have been less than 4,000 tons, of which a tenth part to the Gray Lion. Assuming half of this 400 tons had been spent on the maintenance of his army, the building of the temple and other public works, this still left the staggering figure of 200 tons of gold that might be hidden in or near the city. 200 tons represents a fortune of almost £80 million. When I showed my calculations to Lorin on his next visit to the site, I saw the gold-greed glitter in the pale blue eyes. He took away the sheet of paper with my workings on it, and the following morning, as he was about to board the Lear for Johannesburg, he remarked casually, "You know, Ben, I really think that you and Ral should spend more time exploring the area along the cliffs rather than living in those archives." "What should we look for, Lo?" As if I didn't know. "Well, those old boys were dab hands at hiding things away. They must have been the most secretive people in history. And we still haven't found their burial grounds." "So, you want me to go grave hunting?" I grinned at him and he laughed. "Well, of course, Ben, if you happened to stumble on their treasury, I wouldn't hate you for it. After all, 80 big M's. Nice piece of petty cash." We had transferred 261 jars from the archives to the repository, and Eldridge and Sally had sufficient material to keep them busy for the next 2 or 3 months. So I decided to follow Lauren's suggestion and suspend work in the archives and undertake another detailed search of the area. My timing was impeccable. Ral was within 5 feet of where the small jars with the sunburnt seals on their lids were standing in the darkest corner of the last recess. They were tucked away behind the front rank of jars twice their size, and so effectively hidden by them that we'd not included them in our original count. Ral was working his way steadily towards them. Another 3 days would have been enough, but I took him away to search the cliffs. This was November, which we called the Suicide Month in Africa. The sun was a hammer and the earth an anvil, but we worked the cliffs despite it. We rested only for 2 hours in the middle of the day, when the heat was murderous, and the cool green waters of the Emerald Pool were irresistible. We were alert now to the tricks and subterfuges of the ancient men of Opet. Having learnt from bitter experience how skillfully they could cover their tracks, and how cunningly their masons could conceal the joints in their masonry, I went back over ground I'd already covered. I used my own tricks to try and outthink them. Ral and I re-photographed every inch of the cavern walls, but this time with infrared film. We found no more concealed passages. From there, we worked outwards. Each day I marked off a 300-foot section, and we combed this minutely. Not content merely to eyeball the rocks, we searched by sense of touch also, groping our way over them like blind men. Each day brought its small adventures. I was chased by a black member, 8 feet of irritability and sudden death, with eyes like glass beads and a flicking black tongue, that resented my prodding around in the crack which was its home and castle. Ral was very impressed with my turn of speed over broken ground, and suggested I took it up professionally. A week later, I could return his sallies in kind by remarking on the improvement that 20 wild bee stings made to his appearance. His face looked like a hairy pumpkin, and his eyes were slits in the swollen flesh. For 5 days, poor Ral was of no use to me at all. November passed, and in mid-December we had a quarter of an inch of rain, which is about par for the course in this part of Africa. It laid the dust for an hour or so, and that was the end of the rainy season. I guessed that the ancient lake of Opet would have ensured a higher and more regular rainfall for the area. Open water encourages rain, both by its evaporation and by cooling the air to aid precipitation. Ral and I worked on without results, but also without any diminution of our determination or enthusiasm. Despite our days of wearing labor under the killer sun, we spent most of our evening poring over the map of the foundations of the city. By a process of guess, deduction, and elimination, we tried to work out where the ancients would have sited their tombs. I had by now become extremely fond of Ral Davidson, and I saw in this big, gangling, indefatigable youth the makings of one of the giants of our profession. There would be a permanent post for him at the Institute once this dig was finished. I would see to that. In contrast to our results, Eldridge Hamilton, assisted by Sally and Leslie, continued to reap the rich and enchanting harvest of the scrolls. Each evening I would spend an hour in the air-conditioned repository with them, reviewing the day's work. Steadily the sheets of typed translation piled up, the margins thick with notes and references in Eldridge's spidery and untidy hand. Christmas came, and we sat out under a moon as big as a silver gong, exchanging gifts and companionship. I gave them White Christmas in the style of Bing Crosby, even though the night temperature was in the high 80s. Then Eldridge and I did Jingle Bells as a duet. Eldridge had forgotten the words, all except the jingling part. He was a great little jingler, was our Eldridge, especially after 10 large gins. He was still jingling away merrily when Ral and I carried him off to bed.